The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wolgamott, you have a motion for us.
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes from our March 9th, 2023 meeting, and I would like to move their adoption.
Representative Wolgamott, who was in attendance at the last meeting, moves the minutes of that meeting. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2613, Representative Lizegard. Representative Lizegard, I am going to move that House File 2613 be referred to the General Register, and I believe you have a clarifying amendment for that. And Representative Davids has volunteered to propose that amendment. So, Representative Davids.
Mr. Chair, I would move the H2613A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
The motion before the committee is the amendment. Discussion to the amendment, Representative Lizegard.
It's just a date, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, of Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. If this is the correct one, it says prioritizing students in the Minnesota Economic Development Region 3. Is that correct?
That's the one I have. Is that the correct amendment?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yes, it is.
Representative Lizegard.
My apologies. I got 5 bills up today.
All right.
So could you just explain what it does? I'm sorry. Could you just explain what it does?
All right. And I think this is Ms. Williams?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Lynn Williams. I work for the University of Minnesota, and on the Duluth campus, I oversee marketing, public, and government relations. So the amendment that comes forward very well fits within what is already being done here. It means that the geographical area that this bill relates to will be exclusive to Minnesota Economic Development Region 3, which also happens to be the region that we're already utilizing for these funds as they are. Just specifies that in state statute.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't oppose the amendment, but I would suggest that we want it to be open to students from everywhere. So I'm a little hesitant about putting stuff like this in statute, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. You just said, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Lislegard. So the language says prioritizing. The testifier just said exclusive. To me, those are two different words. If you could clarify, please.
Ms. Williams?
Yeah, I am sorry. We added the language prioritize specifically to keep some flexibility so that it could be expanded. For example, if a student from the Twin Cities who wanted to work up on the range and in those STEM-related programs related to mining, we would want to be able to offer this kind of support to that student.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Cleburne.
I think that was the confusion. So thank you very
Representative
much.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
You're fine. Mm-hmm. Any further discussion to the David's A1 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adopting the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. A1 amendment is adopted, and House File 2613, Representative Lizegard, should be in the order that you want.
Yeah.
So to the bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present 2613. This bill seeks to modernize language in the state statute that provides structure around the University of Minnesota's permanent university trust fund. These updates aim to better utilize available funding through the university account to bring more benefits in workforce development to the Iron Range region in Northeast Minnesota. This bill does not ask for more money. It's just an update to the language, and with me, I do have Ms. Williams that can testify and go into more detail.
Ms. Williams.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your time today. Thank you to Representative Lizegard for carrying this and for your leadership to get us to this point. So a little bit of background. I'll do a little bit of background on permanent university funding just very quickly. The 1851 charter that formed the University of Minnesota included lands granted by the United States Congress in support of a university. This is essentially what is part of what makes us a land-grant institution. A significant portion of these permanent university lands contain valuable deposits of iron ore and taconite. Revenue from that land is then deposited into the permanent university fund. You'll hear the university call these PUF funds, P-U-F, PUF funds. The investment management of the PUF funds are under the jurisdiction of the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. The PUF funds are specific and exclusive to the University of Minnesota, and the income must be used to enhance the mission of the university. The fund is split between four different accounts, and there are other accounts that benefit the entire state as a whole. This particular account, and the one that we're looking at the language, is just one of the four. This changes to this language do not affect the other portions, and they do not change any of the details in the other portions of the account. They only impact this one portion that is already designated to UMD. As mentioned, the goal is to modernize the language. We think we can do more with what is available to us. UMD and the Swenson College of Science and Engineering take our land grant institution very seriously, and that responsibility that comes with it to support education on the Iron Range industries and in their communities. The way the language was originally written, the funding for the endowment can be used for one singular engineering program. And we do that, and we do it well. UMD fulfills that through our Iron Range Engineering Program, which provides very important programming for practicing engineers who are on the range. But there is more good that we can do, and there is money there that we could use to more benefit. These changes will essentially allow us to open that up and broaden it for more than just that one singular academic program. And it stays true to the original intent. With these changes, we would be able to immediately provide 300 additional scholarships to graduate and undergraduate schools studying science and engineering from Northeast Minnesota, an immediate impact for students and for education access. The funds maintain the focus on workforce development and collaboration benefiting regional academics, industry, and the natural resources in northeastern Minnesota. And it maintains the collaboration that we have with Minnesota North College. UMD's Iron Range Engineering Program currently has an office in Minnesota North College, and we continue to grow and expand that partnership with them. They're a very important partner for us. With the change and the additional resources that will automatically come with it, we want to expand that to all of the Minnesota North campuses. We hope to have more alignment and collaboration with those schools to better support students who want to transfer to UMD and complete their four-year degree after having 2 years at one of those Minnesota North schools on the range. As well, with this additional funding, we plan to expand our K-12 outreach to get more students interested in STEM degrees while they're in K-12 and thinking about their career opportunities. And we look forward to doing that in collaboration with Minnesota North as well. The other recommended update that we have is to change the fixed scholarship dollar amount. It currently says $6,500, and we're asking for that to be a percentage of 75%, so it fluctuates as tuition changes over time. With these tweaks to the language, the university feels we can more effectively use the available resources that are there and bring great benefit to northeastern Minnesota, to the students, and to our communities. We ask and appreciate your support in moving this forward. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that this program began in 2013. That's correct. The testifier shaking her head, yes. And so over that period of time, how many students have taken advantage of this program?
Ms. Williams.
Thank you very much. Good question. The program has been pretty narrowly focused because of that one engineering program. So for example, this last year we were able to draw, I believe the amount that was withdrawn from the program was about $700,000 in the last fiscal year, and that gave, I think, somewhere between five scholarships. So you'd be looking at about four, five, six scholarships a year since 2013, since the inception. It also supports additional programming as well, so academic programming in addition to student scholarship.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier or the bill's author. So it says up to $25 million is credited in the endowment to an endowment. What's the balance in that separate account right now?
Ms. Williams.
The endowment currently is about $14 million. In that particular fund.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so some of these students, there's engineering. Are some of these students like geology majors, or could you expound a little bit more some of the other programs that are involved here?
Ms. Williams.
Science, technology, engineering, and math as a whole. So really, the depth of what is under our science and engineering program. So that does include geology or mathematics, other programs that would be related to STEM fields as a whole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe I'm not getting this right. I thought this was just to do mineral-type research, or is it STEM with the underlying focus on mineral research?
Ms. Williams.
So the research component stays the same and is actually run through Natural Resources Research Institute. So the research end of this stays and doesn't change, and that is mining, metallurgical, and mining related, and that stays the same. The way the language is written, it kind of splits this section into two funds. One for Natural Resources Research Institute stays the same, and then this other one for the scholarship and academic programming. Does that make sense?
Thank you. And so the academic piece of it, again, to Representative Robbins' previous question, is focused or prioritized on students from this particular region. So maybe I'm trying to get my head around what this actually does.
Ms. Williams?
Correct. With the idea being that workforce development around STEM, there's a multiple different career fields that help the Iron Range and the workforce development needs of northeastern Minnesota with that broader science, but expanding beyond just that one engineering, mining engineering, and looking for other type careers that still relate to the industry and the workforce needs of the region, but still stay true to that original intent of mining related, technology related, science related.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is there any requirement that these students who get these scholarships, which they're very generous scholarships, is there any requirement that they stay on the range and apply what they've learned?
Ms. Williams.
I'll say that the scholarship dollar amount being $6,500 doesn't mean that every scholarship will be $6,500. So I'll say that to begin with. That does allow us some flexibility for some of those students who maybe we would want to be positioning against some of the competitors they're considering, like Michigan Tech or the North Dakota schools, which very much are the kind of schools that we're in competition for. So the intent, while we can't put restrictions around scholarships like that in terms of where they would work or where they will stay afterwards, the hope and the intent here is very much that we would be able to take Northeast Minnesota students who want to be in these careers, who want a four-year degree and are currently considering UMD, and quite frankly, our biggest competition outside of Twin Cities, that's our sister school, that's fine, is Michigan Tech in North Dakota. So these local kids are choosing to go to those other schools, and this program will allow us to be more incentivized to staying in the area, and we hope by doing that through internships and other opportunities, they will then be more embedded for their careers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so are you keeping data on how many of them that received the scholarships in the past are actually staying?
Ms. Williams.
So right now, it's almost a guarantee because it's the Iron Range Engineering Program. It's people who are working on the range right now. So with this, we do keep data on all of our alumni in terms of where they work, and that is something that we can definitely be tracking as we move forward.
This will be my final comment. And thank you for helping me get a better understanding mm-hmm. of this program. And I think and I hope, especially for the future, I hope that it's needed. I hope that these students can apply what they've learned and be able to mine the precious minerals in the Iron Range that so far the party across the aisle has prohibited from happening. So these students are getting a great education, and we want to keep them in the state of Minnesota, but they're not going to stay here if there's no reason to stay and apply what they've learned. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think this is a great conversation to have, and folks on this aisle are supportive of the Iron Range. We're willing to invest in looking into different mods of economic opportunity, especially with the workforce shortage across the country. We understand also with the federal CHIPS and science, this will be able to leverage that resources if we are intentional, because the systems that we're using is changing. And I want people to be more focused into the future, because if we are not ready, we're going to lose. So how do we ensure that this program is well aligned with the intentionality of moving into the future workforce and creating more opportunities in the Iron Range?
Ms. Williams.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. Our Swenson College of Science and Engineering dean was not able to be here today, but she will ultimately lead the execution of this. And she has worked really hard in her time here and plans to maintain it in terms of how do we find those connections with the industry, with the region, what are their needs. So for example, a very brief example and something we hope to expand upon is she's been taking her faculty every fall before the start of the semester, including all new faculty, up to the range for 2 to 3 days to meet with industry partners and to meet with people across the region to talk about what their needs are so that those new faculty who are coming to this area have a better idea of what those regional needs are and how they can align their research to it. And with that comes things like what are the academic outcomes that you're looking for. So that is very much an active conversation right now, and I believe will continue and expand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Representative Liz Leggett for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Members. Representative Liz Leggett, as far as the minerals being mined, the ore, the iron ore, what other precious metals will be allowed or are being mined up there now? I'm very aware, even out in my county, that there's great precious metals of nickel and palladium and copper and some of the largest deposits in the world. And our founding fathers of the state were wise enough to put it into land trust for our kids' education. So it's a beautiful system. It's a great idea and bill and program long before any of us were born. So thank God they had the insight and the knowledge to do so, hopefully. But there are certain elements here in our state and nation that prohibits some mining of our great precious metals there. So I'm just curious, what other precious metals are going to be mined from this? And are you concerned at all, Representative Lissigard, as we go forward, that certain legislation will not allow some of this precious metals to be mined in the future to keep this ongoing very precious program available?
Representative Lissigard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. You know, I know the chair, and we'll keep this tight strike zone. But I would love to address that. First and foremost, it is a very, very long, cumbersome process, permitting is. But everybody forgets that PolyMet received their permits in 2019. So the state of Minnesota and the federal government went through the process and deemed that PolyMet can move forward. Now, the system and the process also allows for challenges in court. That is the current system that we have. I think it takes a little too long, myself personally, but make no mistake about it that that it is fully permitted. It is just being challenged right now. They're down to three, but I do foresee this happening and moving forward. I will say that you cannot, this country and this society cannot export our jobs and our conscience over sees the third world countries that don't have the same environmental or labor standards while we transition in this country and in this world. So the moment is before us. We are blessed to have this resource. But companies that are committed to following the process, both state and federal, meeting or exceeding those standards need to be allowed to go. And PolyMet has proven that.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Representative Lissigard, that is a brilliant thing to say, and you're a great advocate and fighter for the range, as you should be and continue to be. That's all I have for questions. Representative Scott asked some good questions that I also wanted to ask, but you already did it so dutifully well about the students going forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lissigard, for bringing House File 2613. I certainly support it, and with the amendment added. But I do have a great concern that as these graduates come out with their degrees in the various STEM areas, that they have a place to work. Because so far everything's either shut down in the courts or shut down here or shut down there. We've got to get on with it. And so I hope this will be included in the bill. Is this moving separately or that this would be included in the omnibus bill?
Representative Lissigard, you want to respond?
To the question? Or
David,
well, I agree with everything that he said, that we do need to have places for them to work and the opportunity to provide for their families and strengthening our communities, no question about it.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, to 2613 as amended, is that moving separately, or would that would be, since it's finance, it would be in the omnibus bill?
The motion is to send it to the general register as amended.
I like it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lislegard. I also want to say thank you for bringing the bill. I appreciate the fact that it expands the programs. Mm-hmm. No industry is stagnant, needing only one skill set. And so this allows individuals to be able to be educated for this particular area, mm-hmm. but if other areas in the range open up, it also allows them to have the skill set necessary to continue to stay on the range in different employment opportunities as well. So thank you for broadening the scope and for allowing our families on the range mm-hmm. to have these extra opportunities. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Lizegard to the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It is always an honor to be in front of your committee. I appreciate any support that we could have moving this forward. Thank you.
I also want to recognize that Roy Smith was here from the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, and we appreciate his presence just in case we have a question. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2613, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1340, Representative Wolgamott. And members, we're now in the area that these bills are in the possession of the committee. They'll stay in possession of the committee until we decide what we are going to do with our target and omnibus bill in the future. Representative Wolgamott, to House File 1340.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you this morning to present House File 1340. I bring this bill before you, Mr. Chair, because currently Minnesota's healthcare workforce is facing a crisis level of shortages. In fact, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development estimates that there are currently 52,000 total healthcare job vacancies in our state, including over 7,000 vacancies and allied health occupations alone. Now, Mr. Chair, I know this is the Higher Education Committee, not the Health Policy and Finance Committee, mm-hmm. so I just want to make sure that you and members of the committee are familiar with what classifies as allied health occupations. That would be medical laboratory technologists, medical laboratory technicians, respiratory therapists, radiology technologists, or surgical technologists. These professions play a critical role in making sure that my constituents and your constituents get the health care that they need. This current health care workforce shortage crisis requires unique and multifaceted solutions, including significant investments in higher education. That's why I'm bringing forward House File 1340, to address this crisis by offering scholarships to recruit a new generation of allied health technicians here in Minnesota. Here's how the bill works, Mr. Chair and members. It's a simple, straightforward bill to establish a one-time scholarship program for students newly enrolled in accredited allied health technician programs in Minnesota, starting with the 2024-2025 academic school year. It also requires a report from the Office of Higher Education on the scholarships, including information on which allied health technician field the recipients choose, which schools they attend, where they work after completing the program, and the relevant demographic data. Now, our goal here is to make sure that this money is going towards the use that we intended to, so that you'll see online on page 2, line 3, applicants are required to submit to the commissioner a completed affidavit affirming the student's intent to work in the specified health technician field following the graduation. This is consistent with other Office of Higher Education standards. Each student will receive a total of $5,000 with the goal to award 1,000 scholarships to individuals pursuing career as in those professions that I mentioned, medical laboratory professionals, respiratory therapists, radiology technicians, or surgical technologists. Mr. Chair and members, that is what the bill does. That's why we're bringing this bill forward. And with that, I have some testifiers who can further underscore the need to include House File 1340 in our final education finance omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Let's go to the first one. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
Chair Pulaski and members of the committee, my name is Heather Fauché, and I'm the current director of respiratory care at St. Cloud Hospital at CentraCare. I've served in this current role for 7 months, however, have held leadership positions across the state of Minnesota for the last 13 years. I'm also heavily involved with the Minnesota Board of Respiratory Care and the Association of Respiratory Care. And today I'm here to strongly support HF1340 and the proposed scholarships for allied health technicians. Excuse me. Pre-pandemic, hospitals across the state of Minnesota and the nation have struggled to find respiratory therapists to fill open positions. In 2020, the COVID pandemic further exacerbated the need of respiratory therapists to take care of a mass volume of critically ill patients. Sadly, the COVID pandemic has depleted our pool of respiratory therapists across the state, with many therapists reducing their hours, leaving the profession, or choosing early retirement. At the current rate, the American Association of Respiratory Care projects that we will lose, projects approximately 92,000 RTs across the nation will leave the profession or retire by 2030. We estimate that we will need approximately 150,000 RTs to fill the national need and to meet the projected growth of the profession, with now over 100 million Americans affected by respiratory disease. We are in desperate need of respiratory therapists at this point to join our rapidly growing profession. Respiratory therapists are an essential part of the multidisciplinary team, providing specialized services to some of our sickest patients. With advancements in technology and research over the last 10 years, respiratory therapists have been able to treat and save some of our smallest patients, utilizing new ventilation strategies to support their fragile lungs. Therapists are utilized in the care of individuals with both acute and chronic illness. They care for patients both inpatient and outpatient settings, from neonatal to adult. The care provided by a respiratory therapist directly impacts the length of stay, ventilation and ICU days, readmissions, quality and safety of our patients. There are so many different options for employment for anyone that chooses to go into this field, and the options are growing faster than we can produce RTs. Over the last few years, enrollment into respiratory care programs within Minnesota has dropped by 27%, despite active recruitment leaving open seats at local colleges. We only graduated 60 students for the whole state last year, so that's significantly lower than what we have had in previous years. Hospitals across the state have poured a significant amount of time and money into recruiting employees using strategies to grow their own and large sign-on bonuses. CentraCare is committed to raising awareness to the current RT shortage, offering sign-on bonuses that can go towards loan repayment for students, and actively participating in high school career fairs and working with local colleges to build a pipeline into this field. These scholarships are needed to help our continued efforts to bring more students into this high-demand profession. I truly believe this bill will have a significant impact on assisting with the recruitment efforts and ease a financial burden off students. These scholarships will help reduce barriers to higher education for Minnesotans, drive interest in the critical healthcare field of allied health, and is important to and necessary step towards ensuring timely access for Minnesotans. We appreciate Representative Wolgamont for authorizing this bill and being a strong advocate for health professionals who are critical for the healthcare teams and patient care. Thank you for this opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I will ask for your support of HF 1340. Thank you. Knowing the substantial impact it will have for individuals in critical situations. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wolgamont, next. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Rebecca Lamberty, and I serve as the Chief Administrative Officer for Winona Health, an independent rural healthcare system with a 49-bed hospital, multi-specialty clinic, nursing home, and assisted living facility. I began my career serving the community of Winona in the emergency department as a nurse in 1998, and throughout my career, I've gained a deep understanding of both clinical and organizational leadership perspectives. I'm here today testifying in strong support of House File 1340. Today's healthcare workforce shortage is a threat to the health and well-being of our communities across the state. This shortage is exacting a heavy burden, not just on my team in Winona, but on healthcare teams across the state of Minnesota. High quality healthcare demands excellent teamwork for more than just physicians and nurses. Our allied health professionals, like laboratory technicians, technologists, radiology technicians, surgical technicians, and respiratory therapists, are essential. Without them and their expertise, there will be an impact to health outcomes for our community members. Our allied health professionals work across the continuum of care from birth to end of life. They're found in our hospitals, our clinics, our nursing homes. By way of example, Winona currently has a 25% vacancy rate for our respiratory therapists, and we have for more than 2 years. In 2021, MDH survey data showed that 27% of respiratory therapists were planning to leave their profession within 5 years. That's up from 18% in 2019. The average age of our respiratory therapists in Winona is 50. This workforce data is similar for all of our allied health professionals. This is not sustainable and has a negative impact on access to care. I strongly support House File 1340 and the Allied Health Scholarship Program it seeks to establish. The healthcare workforce uniquely relies on higher ed, and the cost of education continues to rise. Scholarships will help reduce the barriers to education and will increase the number of Minnesotans seeking rewarding careers in healthcare. Thank you for your time today. It's been an honor. Please support House File 1340. Thank you.
Ms. Lamberti, thank you, and I appreciated the meeting at Winona Health on Friday with you and others. It was very enlightening. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You have one last person, Representative Gordon, to testify.
I don't believe I do. Oh, I do. Yes, thank you.
Yes, you do, Representative Gordon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Chris Ziegler. I am the Senior Director of ASC Operations for Twin Cities Orthopedic, and I'm also a board member of Minnesota Ambulatory Surgical Center. I urge you to vote in favor of the Allied Health Scholarship, as these technical careers are a great career option in healthcare and can provide an annual salary of approximately $78,000. These careers are lifelong careers for many individuals, and they're a vital piece of our success in healthcare. Minnesota ASCs, clinics, and hospital partners are all competing for the same small pool of candidates. We have seen an increase in length of time to fill these positions from 40 days to 145 days. Many ASCs have at least one position open in these areas and are not able to fill these positions due to the lack of candidates. One of our ASC will have both of their full-time rad tech positions open by the end of the month, and we're not sure how we will be able to conduct surgeries when they leave. One employee is now doing the work of two employees and is causing strain on all of our ASCs. You may ask how this affects you or your family. Imagine you or your loved one is being scheduled for a surgery for tomorrow at 8 a.m. You expect to arrive for your appointment at 6 a.m., but you receive a phone call the day before delaying your surgery either 2 hours because a tech has called in and the ASC doesn't have enough staff to conduct your surgery at 8. Or worse, when they call you the day before, they cancel your surgery entirely because the right amount of staff are not present who work that day. This is happening in Minnesota ASCs today. I am aware that this bill will not solve the immediate issues we have, but will be a good use of taxpayer money and will increase the candidate pool, offer sustainable careers to individuals, and improve health care for all. Again, please vote in favor, and I thank you for this opportunity to speak and offer to answer any questions you may have.
Members, discussion to the bill. Representative McCown. I'm sorry, Representative Robbins was first, so you're going to have to wait.
Ladies first.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, seems like a great bill. I just had a couple questions. What's the cost of one of these training programs? How much of the scholarship funds the program?
Representative Wolgamott, do you want to answer that, or?
I guess I can, I'd be happy to point your, as far as the cost of the bill, I'd be happy to bring your attention to page 3. The bill is seeking $5.38 million. $5 million of that goes to the scholarships. You can see there on 3.7, $230,000 for the promotion of the program and recruitment efforts. And then to your question, Representative Robbins, on line 3.8, $150,000 is appropriated for administering the program.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually wondering, like, the cost to the student of being enrolled in one of these programs and how much of the scholarship, the $5,000, offsets that. I think someone behind you can help.
I think we've got someone else coming in. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Fantastic question. We have looked, done a little literature review of all the costs. It does vary by location and college and university. We estimate that it's anywhere from 10 to 30 grand, depending on which allied health field they go into. So for $5,000 does put a significant dent into that and reduces the barrier. And again, this is modeled also after the 1,000 CNA program that has been wildly successful. And one of the takeaways of that is reducing barriers as best you can, invites people to pursue those careers. And that's what we're trying to do. So,
Representative Robin.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Thank you.
And just last question is, in the area where you have the requirement that they certify they're going to work in this field, it doesn't specify that they have to stay in Minnesota, and I get we probably can't do that, but I also don't see that as part of the reporting requirements, so I would just like to encourage, as the reporting requirements are developed, that they track where the student gets employed. Thank you.
Representative Wilgemon, I think the Office of Higher Ed is here also. I saw perhaps behind the elevator again. the staff person, but there she is. Thank you. I think they've heard that too, and tracking becomes critical with these programs. So, thank you. Representative Wilgemon.
I'd also like to add, Mr. Chair, and you're absolutely right, Representative Robbins, that's our intention. We can't force someone to stay in the state of Minnesota, but I do know that our healthcare providers have very strong relationships with our colleges and universities, and I know that they are going to be working very hard to cultivate those relationships and do everything they can to use those partnerships to make sure that the students who will be benefiting from these scholarships will get plugged into their local communities and stay here in the state of Minnesota.
Representative McDonald is next. Then Representative McDonald.
Okay, I'll make this quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Representative Wilgemon, just a couple of series quick questions and answers. I think as far as the bill instructs that they must live in Minnesota, so why not put in law that they need to stay in Minnesota for a year, otherwise they have to repay that $5,000 back? I think that's fair enough, because in law we already say they have to be in Minnesota, they have to be a Minnesotan, so why not give them that year? We got great health care in Minnesota. Once they're working in the field for a year, most likely they'll stay, you know, they'll fall in love, they get married, they raise a family. So I don't see why we couldn't put that in the bill, and then if they do move, which is fine, it's a free country, they have to repay that $5,000 back. The average pay is $78,000. I think someone could afford that if they decided to move to Florida, and I don't blame them. Second question. You can respond to that if you want.
Representative Wilgemon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Again, Representative McDonald, it certainly is our intention to make sure that these people who benefit from this stay in Minnesota. I would want to look more into the legality of that and how that would be. What you just proposed would be put into execution, but certainly open to ideas to have the bill reach its intended goal of making sure that the people who are benefiting from these scholarships are becoming a part of our healthcare workforce here in Minnesota.
Representative McDonald.
That'd be great. Thank you, Representative Wilgemon. Wonderful. I think that's a good idea, and let's look into that. Why not? Has this program been done before for the technical the tech field?
Representative Wilgemon or Mr. Ackert?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, to our knowledge, no. A dedicated scholarship program as such, like this, has never been done. However, I am aware that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, along with some of our members, are participating in scholarship programs already, and there's other scholarship programs that exist. So this is more targeted towards these allied health technicians specifically, given the fact that their demand is increasing every day.
Representative McDonald.
And I think it's a good idea as well. I support the bill. Then lastly, what is the length of time for a certificate for the student to go to school? And then just a caveat, you know, they're going to spend $380,000 for promotion, recruitment, and administering the program. That's a lot of money, even though it's a $3.8 million bill. What are the efforts to recruit them? Are they starting at the school level? And then how long is the program that they attend for the certificate?
Representative Wilmot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. Yes, so, and this is kind of consistent with other other OHE standards for promotion. So this would include websites, mailers, going into high schools and doing that on the ground recruitment.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Just then, lastly, the second part of my question is, how long is a tech school? Is it a 18-month or 2-year certificate, 3-year?
Mr. Ackley.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, most allied health technician programs are 2 years. Some are 4. And some require a bachelor's, while others require an associate's degree. So it is kind of a scattershot of how much time, but there's always an advancement within each career to go back to school and continue to get more certificates, become more specialized.
Representative McDonald.
Okay, I'm sorry, last question. Now, like Twin Cities Orthopedic, we had a testifier up here speaking to them. They do very well, and I'm well aware of some people who had an appointment get canceled because they couldn't have the technician wasn't there. Do they also have recruitment incentives, sign-on bonuses? Are they also in the industry helping to get people back in the industry and working in tangent with the state? Can't be just the state doing it. They have to be, and I'm sure they are, working to get these new recruits in to learn the field.
I think we've got the answer to your question. Welcome back, Ms. Lee.
Yes, great questions. We do sign on bonuses. We are also looking into recruitment. We're looking at having our HR department, my team, also go to high schools just to do more promotions because we really need to get these candidates into the schooling.
So, Representative Wilgamond, I just was asking staff about the requirement of having someone stay in Minnesota, and they're working on what could be language for that. So if you wish to use it at a future date, the bill is still in possession of the committee, and we can work on draft language for that. Representative Kleber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was confused a little bit. I think that Representative McDonald said that $380,000 was used for administration, but in the bill it says $150,000, which is 3% or less. So that's a very low administrative fee. That's just a clarifying, and if I misheard, I apologize, but that's a low management administrative cost. But my question, I'm looking at this. You know, we have been spending much time, Mr. Chair, talking about enrollment in our public institutions. Right, and I looked online to see how many of these career areas are served by our public institutions. You know, it seems to me that this bill could serve a dual purpose of both serving students and helping us fill that excess capacity in our institutions. So I would just suggest to the chair that maybe when we look at this, since it's in possession of the committee, that we consider our public institutions as recipients of this, of these.
Representative Cleavorn, the intent of listening to these bills, and this committee does not listen to many bills, is to do exactly that.
Right.
We have spent 2 months on budgets and particularly on declining enrollment. We have also spent time on needs, and we have a series of needs that need to be addressed. So if a bill is being heard in this committee, there's a purpose for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, who? Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Cleburne. I did state actually lines 3.7 and 3.8. I bundled them together with a total of 380,000. But I speak kind of fast since it's getting close to St. Patrick's Day, but I will be more clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, then Representative Wilgamond.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present House File 1340. Let's ensure that our healthcare workforce is able to meet the healthcare needs of our constituents. I urge your full consideration for including House File 1340 in our higher education finance omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Wilgamond. And again, I'm going to repeat, if we're hearing a bill in this committee, there's a purpose for it, and Representative Cleavorn brought it up, and we're going to keep emphasizing that. We want to build our bill as we see the needs, and we've exposed a number of needs. So Next on the agenda is Representative Knorr. House File 467, and again, this is in possession of the committee. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 467 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
I'm going to correct you, Representative Knorr. A member cannot move a bill to be laid over. Only the chair can move a bill to be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we do not have motions to lay bills over because we are in possession of the bill. So I know it's becoming common practice around this place to do it, and it's sloppy, and frankly, it doesn't work. So we're in possession of the bill. We're going to keep in possession of the bill. The bill's before us, and you have an amendment, I believe, and we need to put that amendment on.
I have a DE1, Mr. Chair.
To the DE1, Representative Knorr moves the DE1 amendment. To the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the entire bill, so I will go over. Mr. Chair, this is the emergency assistant for post-secondary students. Members, if you all know, we have got so many students who are homeless, who are facing financial insecurity, especially with housing crisis that we have, with also food insecurity. Likewise, there are students who are facing minor emergencies that this program, when it was created, was intended to serve students when they have good needs and their families. This bill appropriates $7.55 million for fiscal year 24-25, provides $5 million for fiscal year 24-25 for Minnesota State Colleges, $2 million for University of Minnesota for 24-25, appropriates $500,000 for the tribal colleges and eligible nonprofit institutions. It also provides $50,000 for administration through the Office of Higher Education. Members, this bill, this IPS program was created in 2017. And during the pandemic, we saw the need that went up, and thank goodness we had the federal program that supported many of the students. To that, Mr. Chair, that's all what the bill is before us.
All right, we're on the A1 amendment, members. So discussion to the A1 amendment. I'm sorry.
DE1, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, DE1, sorry. To the amendment.
Mr. Chair, that was essentially the entire bill as the amendment. So
all right,
I would ask for the
DE1 members. Representative Ruff.
Thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing this bill. And I see that the program has been around since 2017. So I wondered if you could, has there been any reporting requirements about how many students have used it and how they use the money? And are the students required to provide any documentation of how they use the money, or once they get the grant, they can just spend it however they want?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware there's always a report produced by the Office of Higher Education. If I can phone a friend, Mr. Chair.
Representative Roberts.
That would be great.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I'd like to note I was not hiding behind an elevator today. to your question, we do develop a report. I do have the program administrator here if you want actual numbers for how many students received the program, the funding we run, and the way the program is ran currently is the money goes to the institutions, and the institutions run their own individualized programs because they know their students best. Students, it varies across institutions how they run the program and what information the student must apply to them, and what it also depends on what their need is. Most students are applying for transportation emergencies and housing emergencies. So institutions can issue checks directly to vendors or repair shops, and not directly to the student.
Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yeah, I would love to see a broader report on how the program is run and the reporting requirements. I think it's really important that we track that well. And I had one more question. Thank you. And while you're here, so are nonprofits currently eligible as well to receive this money, or is that new under the DE?
Ms. Oliver.
Chair, Representative, nonprofit institutions are eligible for receiving the grant funds.
Representative Robin.
Thank you. So just any additional information you provide on the nonprofits who receive it as well would be great. Thank you.
Ms. Oliver, you want to?
Nope. Yes, Chair. I will forward you the latest report and also the numbers of in current participating institutions.
Representative Cleveland.
Can I clarify?
I'm sorry, Ms. Holler.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify, they're the post-secondary institutions, not nonprofit organizations. Just making that clear. They're colleges.
Representative Robin.
Thank you. So that's why I'm asking, is the language that allows it now to also go to non-eligible nonprofits new to the program? It's lines 1.13.
Ms. Oliver.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, it's still the nonprofit institutions, post-secondary institutions under Minnesota statute. So the references which institutions we're talking about. It's not nonprofit organizations. It's nonprofit post-secondary institutions.
That clarifies it.
I guess I'm sure they'll be listed in the report you sent, so I'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Right, Representative Lieberman, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, my question was really about protecting the privacy of the students, and I don't know how the data, when we look at this, I just want to make sure that we are making always honoring and respecting the privacy of the student, and that in no way would the data be trackable as to what student would be homeless or what student, but just as disaggregated data. Is that correct?
Ms. Oliver.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, we all in the institutions have to abide by FERPA laws, so we do protect the students' data.
Awesome. Representative Cleavorn.
Awesome. Just making sure. Thank you so much.
Further questions to the amendment? We have one more, I think, testifier, Representative Knorr. You have two testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. Maya Sullivan, Dean of Students at Metropolitan State University. Thank you for allowing me to be here. So yesterday, I received an email from one of our students, and in the title, it stated they had a dire financial emergency. Our student detailed financial challenges they have experienced and detailed their financial needs. They shared how not receiving support would likely cause their academic journey to end for now, and they shared how ending their academic journey for now would be devastating in many ways. I am saying our student because this is Metropolitan State University student, but they are also your student. And in fact, all of Metropolitan State University students are our students and your students, as are Minn State students. They are on an educational path that can be simply appended by an often relatively small financial emergency. At Metro State, we know that more than 90% of students receiving emergency financial assistance are retained, so they might complete their academic journey. And therefore, programs like this are necessary to support academic completion and to continue to develop our workforce and economy. So let me just give you a little bit more information about Metro State. We currently have over 9,000 students that we're serving, most of whom are undergraduate and most of whom transferred, and about 60% are part-time. 56% are first-generation students, and 51% of our students are students of color. Metro State also notably ranks 22 in the nation of CollegeNet's 2022 Social Mobility Index. That's the top 1.6%. That index measures an institution's ability to help a student move from low income to mid income within 5 years after they're graduating from college or university. So we currently have a vacancy in our coordinator position, and so I've been supporting this work quite a bit over the last several months. And in this academic year, I can tell you that in this post-COVID world, we have provided support to about close to 80 students in with the funds that we have on our campus. And those funds are primarily from fundraising efforts that our foundation has done over time. A lot of that money comes from employees or other private individuals providing funds. The story that I've shared is a story that's very similar at other institutions in the MnState system, as well as other higher education institutions. And for MnState in general, providing students with access to emergency grants is an essential component of our approach to addressing basic needs and security. What we hear from our students is that, as I mentioned before, a simple financial emergency could cause a significant interference in their academic journey. Another thing that we know is that for many students who have financial emergencies, that is not the only type of basic need issue that they're experiencing. So they may be experiencing the financial emergency. They might also be experiencing food insecurity or housing insecurity or something similar to that. One of the things that we know from our institutions is, like Metro State, many of our other MnState institutions have foundations who are fundraising, receiving private donations to be able to support students with emergency financial assistance. And a lot of that has happened even as we've, again, as I mentioned before, lost funding once the COVID-related federal funds have ended. And even though those funds have ended, we know that the need that students have, of course, has not ended. National studies have demonstrated that emergency grant support makes a significant difference in the ability of students to remain enrolled, succeed academically, and to ultimately complete their degree program, and then to contribute positively to our workforce and economy. Notably, many of our students remain in Minnesota and provide support in our economy and our local industry. And for these reasons, committee members and chair, I would like to ask for your support in HF 467. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share about this most important need and for the opportunity to testify in this hearing.
Thank you, Dean Absolvin. And I think you have one more testifier. Student. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee. My name is Jared Van Horn. I'm a student at Dakota County Technical College and with LEAD-MN, the statewide student association representing Minnesota's 100,000 community and technical college students. And I'm one of those students that, if not for emergency funding, I would not have been, I don't think I would be enrolled in my institution anymore. So I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 467, which is legislation that will provide emergency grants to students in need. Firstly, I'd like to express my gratitude to Representative Knorr for bringing forward this impactful piece of legislation. It'll provide critical support for students in need. Temporary setbacks can place low-income students in vulnerable positions and threaten their college careers and success. While typical financial aid helps make college affordable and accessible, it does not cover additional and increased living expenses for things like rent, utility bills, health care, child care, or other unexpected costs like medical bills, car repairs, or lack of income due to job loss. Emergency grants provide a lifeline to students like me, but these programs were rare before the pandemic. The COVID relief money to higher education institutions was critical in helping so many students stay in school while facing unforeseen costs during the pandemic. Now that the pandemic is over, the need for these programs has not gone away. This legislation is a great tool to give colleges and universities across Minnesota the ability to help vulnerable students complete their degrees. It is worth noting that a number of states had emergency grant programs before the pandemic, from New York to Wisconsin to even here in Minnesota. And a study in New York found that of the students receiving these emergency grants, 94% were still enrolled in college or had successfully graduated or completed their program of study in the semester immediately following the receiving their award. So that represents an 18-point increase in retention rates for New York campuses. That's a significant number. Part of the success of this program is not just the grant itself. The process also increased students' awareness of the broader range of support available to them on campus and in the surrounding community. 8 in 10 recipients noted that applying for the grant caused them to learn about other services and resources that they didn't know about beforehand. So emergency grants provided a critical lifeline to me. When I was living at home with my father, who went on furlough during the pandemic from his job, and the car I relied on to get to school every day broke down. I didn't have enough money to cover the repair costs right then and there, and I was unable to get to school for my required in-person classes until my car got repaired. I was left with really no other options, but luckily Dakota County Technical College offered an emergency grant program, and I was able to fill out the documentation and within the same day receive money to repair my car, and then within that week I was back in school. So this allowed me to overcome a significant obstacle that I really don't see an easy route to overcoming without this emergency grants. So this experience has been a lifeline for me, and it's made it very clear that emergency funds for basic needs are essential for students' well-being and academic success. The amount of money is small, but the impact is huge for every single one of these students. And it's hard to quantify 500 students that have been impacted, but every single one of those students, their stories are legitimately changed because of these emergency funds. And this legislation will allow colleges and universities to scale up this proven program, and it will help boost retention and boost graduation rates. Thank you.
Mr. Van Horn, what area are you going into?
So I'm studying architecture, but I just love learning. I'd like to be a legislator one day, but
What did you learn? Let's see an architecture.
Trust me, I know.
Members. Mr. Van Horn, this building is being redone, so we need good architects.
Yeah.
So it's a great field you're going into. Thank you. And you have one more testifier, Representative Norman. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sia Sacredonde, and I'm the state coordinator for the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm here today in support of House File 467 because of how beneficial emergency grants have been to our students on campus, who are already financially strained with the high cost of tuition and the lack of affordable food and housing options. College students tend to live on extremely tight financial budgets that they have to stick to make ends meet every month. This may mean that towards the end of their budget period, they are running out of food or are forced to pay their rent or tuition later because the money just isn't there. Adding in an emergency financial crisis means that students are left helpless. Our organization's Vice President, Zeke Jackson, shared his personal experience with the financial relief provided by the emergency grants, which I will be sharing with you all today. Zeke benefited from being awarded an emergency grant after he withdrew from a class that he was auditing. This withdrawal caused a reduction in his financial aid, which he was not informed of, and this meant that he would have to pay $400 on the spot. Paying the $400 meant that Zeke would not have enough money to pay for groceries to feed himself. In receiving the emergency grant to pay the balance not covered by his financial aid anymore, Zeke was able to support himself again. On a campus of over 30,000 undergraduate students, Zeke is only one story of dozens of students who undergo similarly stressful financial situations and shocks, ranging from financial aid limitations to emergency medical procedures. Students should not be experiencing consequences for an emergency situation that they do not have any control over, especially when financially supporting yourself through college is hard enough. Increasing awareness of these financial support systems that can assist students during hard times would be the first step to helping students through the financial crisis that they face. Expanding these programs to support more people would be one of the ways that your committee would be able to help soften the financial burden of higher education. Financial assistance is often seen as the solution to the increasing cost of tuition, but when the cost of textbooks, food, and housing are also increasing, emergency funding would be one avenue that could cushion students who are already overworked and often undervalued and underpaid. By funding these direct emergency grants, your committee would be providing the support needed during a time of crisis for many students across our campus and across our state, which is why we're in support of this bill today. Thank you.
Members, I don't believe we've adopted the amendment yet, so why don't we put the bill in order. Representative Knorr moves the DE1 amendment, and we've had discussion on it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in order. Now to the bill as amended. Members. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Say, Representative, I had a question regarding maybe the endowments on the University of Minnesota or other schools. The alumni, of course, and other philanthropic ventures donate to the universities for students. Would this be something that could be used for emergency for the students? I mean, I see that the majority of this is housing, rent, groceries, gas, and a lot of the funds and endowments are philanthropic and donated with great care by previous, you know, alumni or other generous donors. Seems to be, if it's allowed, that would be a good fit for that. Do you have any idea on that?
Nor.
Mr. Chair, I don't speak for the University of Minnesota, but I think there's a requirement for 50% contribution from the institution.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Nor, can you say that again, a 50% investment?
I think there's a requirement for matching funds from the institution, if I'm correct.
Representative McDonald.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nor, matching funds from the university to a student?
Any institution that receives the emergency grant are required to provide a matching fund for that.
Is that right? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Seeing none, then thank you. The bill, as amended, is still in possession of the committee and under consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
The last bill, House File 1339, and now I think I have the correct amendment. Representative Cagle. And Representative Cagle, you have an amendment that you want to have put onto the bill. So I'm going to move the A1 amendment and discussion now to the A1 amendment to House File 1339.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just clarifies that the university is able to use this funding over the two-year period, or I believe over a longer period of time.
So, Representative Cagle, we're now on the amendment, and you wish the testifier to address the amendment? No. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Then all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Any opposed, nay. The bill is now in order. So to the bill is amended. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm glad to present and author House File 1339, which would fund the only addiction medicine fellowship program we have in Minnesota. Since being elected to the legislature, I've been very engaged on the issue of substance abuse disorder and currently serve on the OREC, the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, so understand how this disease is impacting my community and our state as a whole. Access to treatment facilities is limited, and in fact, only about 10% of people with substance use disorders receive the treatment they need. Some of the lack of treatment services is structural. Some of it's due to a lack of well-trained workforce, and some is related to the historical stigma around substance use disorder. It was in 2008 when Congress passed the Mental Health and Addiction Equity Act, Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, and a federal report released in January of this year found insurers and health plans are failing to provide mental health and substance use treatment coverage at the same level as medical and surgery benefits. And it's a major barrier to care, especially for those who are already struggling to find help. We don't have enough clinical providers trained in the specialty of addiction. Graduating physicians out of med school have between 6 and 8 hours of training about a disease that impacts tens of millions of Americans and their families. Over the past several decades, there has been an expanding awareness of the importance of substance abuse education for medical students, residents, and practicing physicians. We're lucky to have one of the first addiction medicine fellowships in the country housed between HCMC and the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatry with rotations at those facilities and the Minneapolis Veterans Hospital. House File 1339 would provide funding to train up to 6 physicians per biennium in the specialty of addiction medicine. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Gavin Bart, and thank you, Chairman Pawlowski. As I said, I'm Gavin Bart. I am a physician and addiction specialist at Hennepin Healthcare, where I direct the Division of Addiction Medicine. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me to testify on behalf of HF 1339 and for Representative Cagle for authoring it along with her many co-authors, and especially I want to thank Representative Baker, who's been a longtime champion of issues related to addiction in Minnesota and has shown his bipartisan support at being a co-author of this bill. I also want to remind the committee that this bill or the contents of this bill were part of last year's omnibus bill. So there's nothing particularly new here, and so I'm hoping, if I may use a golf term, that this time we can make a barkey and pass this bill despite last year's challenges. The bill provides funding for Minnesota's only addiction medicine fellowship training program. It is a partnership between Hennepin Healthcare, the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota VA. We know that for too long, Minnesotans have suffered from problems related to drug use, and that this has affected families and communities, and that they do not always know where to turn to when they need help. We know that if you have cancer in your family, there are oncologists you can turn to, and families can reliably turn to them. We need to have similar access to specialists in addiction. And yes, primary care doctors and other healthcare professionals can help address some issues related to addiction, just as they can help address some issues related to cancer. We still need to have the specialists out there. We need the experts. And so this bill will seek $540,000 per biennium to support the training of 6 fellows per biennium. And the money will cover the stipend and benefits of the fellows, while the administrative cost of running the program and of teaching the fellows is currently being provided in kind by Hennepin, the university, and the VA. So what does Minnesota get for the investment? First, as mentioned, families and their loved ones get experts in preventing, diagnosing, and treating addiction. And then we have graduates who historically we've been able to place in safety net hospitals like Hennepin, to place in communities where they're serving tribal populations. We have our graduates in rural Minnesota and at least one graduate in each of the 5 major healthcare systems in Minnesota. Our graduates have expertise in addiction epidemiology and public health and have served on various governors' task forces and committees, such as the Prescription Opioid Committee, the Medical Cannabis Committee, and the ORAC Committee. And our graduates engage in teaching medical students, residents, and health professionals out in the community. One of our graduates has been the main focus of the educational effort known as ECHO, which MMB has analyzed to show that this program has successfully helped expand addiction education and treatment across the majority of counties in the state of Minnesota. So despite these great successes, we still have more than 325,000 Minnesotans who have an addiction and are not receiving treatment for it. And so these individuals use health care more than others. They're more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system, to have insecure housing, and to be on government assistance. So opportunity for these individuals has been lost. Families and communities grieve, and overdoses continue. We need to expand our workforce to meet the demand. So the investment of HF 1339 is small compared to the benefit of addiction specialists and the help they can bring to Minnesota. So while the federal government has also in parallel been working on reliable funding for addiction workforce expansion, it is not clear in the current federal environment that Minnesota can afford to wait for a federal solution when we have the means to act now to protect our future by making sure that when experts like me or Dr. Specker, who will testify next, are ready to retire, that we have an ongoing flow of addiction experts like our current fellow, Dr. Agenta, who's joined us today in the gallery. So again, I want to thank you for your support and consideration for HF 1339.
Thank you, and I believe we have one more testifier, Representative Cagle. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sheila Specker, and I'm a family physician and addiction psychiatrist faculty at the University of Minnesota and the program director of the Minnesota Addiction Medicine Fellowship, which is shared between Hennepin, the VA Medical Center, and the University of Minnesota, as well as other sites in the community. I also want to thank Representative Cagle for authoring this legislation for the only addiction medicine fellowship in the state. And as you've heard, we've had previous support from this committee last year with the inclusion of it in the House Omnibus Bill. Of the 21 million Americans with an addiction, under 2,000 physicians are only specialized to treat them. The lack of trained specialists and physicians is why only 1 in 10 people with a substance use disorder receive treatment in the United States. And in Minnesota, less than half of the counties had no physician who had federal approval to prescribe a highly effective and life-saving medication of buprenorphine for opioid use disorder. And even with lifting of the requirement to obtain a special waiver to prescribe the medication, physicians are still not trained to use it. And this physician trains, this program trains physicians to be able to train others. We're all acutely aware of the skyrocketing overdose deaths from the synthetic opioids, namely fentanyl. But also the pandemic has triggered an increase in alcohol use and alcohol use disorder, especially among women, and methamphetamine use disorder, especially in rural Minnesota. The Addiction Medicine Fellowship is a 12-month subspecialty program, which began in 1982 and trains physicians of all specialties to become experts in the prevention, clinical evaluation, treatment, and ongoing care of persons that have addiction. My own training in this fellowship led me to take this position as program director and a faculty member at the university. Some of our fellows have come directly from residency, and some have been out in practice for some years. Fellows are trained to treat patients throughout the lifespan with evidence-based therapies. These are medication-assisted therapies in an outpatient treatments and therapies for co-occurring psychiatric problems. We all know the high occurrence of mental health disorders in conjunction with substance use disorders, and hence the importance to treat both of those in one setting, as we teach in our fellowship. As past president of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, I'm acutely aware of the importance of treating both of these disorders together, and our fellows are trained to do so. I want to acknowledge the support of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, as well as our other societies, the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine, for instance, in supporting this bill. Our fellows have been practicing, as Dr. Gavin Bart had mentioned, in all areas of Minnesota, some in academic settings, some in rural settings, underserved settings. Another one of our fellows is practicing at Essentia in Duluth, starting an addiction service, which they have not had. And our current fellow, who you've met, Dr. Agueta, will be working in one of our local hospitals, which has a large population of underserved persons. The program has received formal accreditation by the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education and received temporary approval to increase the number of positions to 4 from 2 because of the great need to expand the workforce. And with the funding, we'll be able to apply for a permanent increase. Each year, the program struggles to cover fellow stipends due to lack of sustainable funding. We do receive partial funding from our institutions and from our partners. Our GME, Graduate Medical Education, programs are funded through federal dollars for which they receive a fixed number of slots, which typically will reach the residency programs and much less so the fellowship programs. This coming 2023-2024 academic year, starting in July, we will have the most fellows we've ever had, which is 4, and demonstrates the passion and commitment of physicians to this field of medicine. We continue to look for sustainable funding. This proposal would allow us to train up to 6 physicians over 2 years. We appreciate past support from the legislature and hope the legislature will invest in our program because we are truly a statewide resource that expands the workforce of physicians trained in addiction and hence can reach populations most in need of addiction care. Thank you again for the committee's time, and I hope for your support.
Dr. Spector, on line 2.4 of the bill, there's the identification and treatment of addictive disorders in special populations. Would that include legislators who are addicted to introducing bills?
It certainly could include that. I know that
this bill becomes an extremely high priority now. We're at 2,876 bills and climbing, so I'm hopeful that you can help many of the House and Senate who are simply addicted to introducing bills.
So yes, Mr. Chair, a good point. Mr. Chair, we're also happy to help any of the legislators that themselves have experienced addiction or family members.
And I know you are. This, but special populations. So members, questions to the bill. Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I honestly believe this is a very important and critical bill, and I've been happy to support it in the past and plan to support it again. But I do have a question. This is about training physicians. In earlier conversations I've had this year at the Capitol with physician assistants, I was stunned to learn how many patients are being treated for mental health by physician's assistants. Mm-hmm. And I'm very concerned that medications could be prescribed that have addictive properties. And how are we reaching the physician's assistants as well? And maybe it's not in this bill, but maybe future legislation that we need to address.
Dr. Spector.
Mr. Chair, I can address that to a certain extent. Right. I supervise a physician's assistant, so I provide training in the here and now. And some of the physician's assistants do essentially an internship in a facility where they want to specialize, but I do not think that that's the case for the vast majority of physicians' assistants. I think that there is much more that we need to do. Some of the training and teaching, such as in this Project ECHO, that Dr. Bart has referred to, is not solely for physicians, but can also be for other healthcare professionals. But I am aware of the training that physicians' assistants receive, and I do think we have more work to do to train.
Mr. Chair, I just want to
Representative Cleburne.
I'd like to just be clear to the committee. I'm not in any way denigrating the work of physicians' assistants. I'm just trying to elevate the fact that we need maybe more education in this area. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne, when I met with Winona Health on Friday, physician assistance was an issue with them also. A high number of physician assistants have to be employed because they simply don't have staff. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue that goes across, I think, all of our healthcare providers.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this bill, Representative Kegel. I really do think I plan to support it. I think it's very important. But I had a question for your testifier. You know, there was a lot of data provided by you and the previous testifier about the level of addiction treatment that's needed in the state. And I just wondered from your perspective if you would comment on the wisdom of legalizing marijuana and what that will do to driving need for additional addiction counseling and treatment.
Mr. Chair, I share your concern. I, as a psychiatrist, have seen particularly youth, and I think that's a particularly vulnerable population because of brain development, develop some condition, psychosis specifically, as a result of using cannabis. Part of what we do as a fellowship is try and make inroads and advocacy. And that's one reason why I wanted Dr. Agenta to come and join us today, because we are very acutely aware of the potential effects of cannabis. And I've been part of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society and the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine, who's taken a stand in terms of our concern about the health effects, particularly on our youth or in our youth.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Representative McDonald, did you have a question?
Yeah, just to use a golf term, thank you for the mulligans of this microphone, Mr. Chairman.
Mulligans are illegal, just so you know.
Not if you pay for them at a fundraiser.
They're still illegal. Oh.
See, a question for the folks. I wasn't going to bring it up, but since Representative Robbins did, I was reading from the Institute of the Boulder, Colorado, their study. It's been 10 years now since they legalized marijuana, and they did find that addiction has gone up. Now, not as significantly as those who heralded it 10 years ago, warning them, but it's very pertinent to this committee. And one of the studies that they found, and I think this is probably common knowledge, but it's always good to read from a scientific study, especially in Colorado, that research from a Tiffany Ido, a professor of psychology and neuroscience, has shown that college students tend to drink more alcohol when using marijuana, a combination that can potentially impact grades and graduation status. That is not good news from this committee. So I just wanted to see what the good doctor, what say you?
Dr. Spector, you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is of major concern. The other major concern about cannabis is the high potency, and this has really increased dramatically through the past several years, as well as contaminants. So we will see cannabis, we'll see other substances such as methamphetamine mixed with fentanyl. So the cannabis of years ago is not the cannabis of today, which means that there is more toxicity to the brain. And there was a study some years ago in Amsterdam which showed a drop of IQ points in college students that were using cannabis. So I certainly share your concern.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for this bill and the need for training for individuals experience substance use disorder. You know, and as a mom of kids who are over 21 and under 21, we have had these conversations about brain development in our family, you know, as well. And it's a similar conversation to the one we have about alcohol. Right, and the importance of this being an adult decision. But of course, sometimes that's not how it works, right? Sometimes children make choices. And I think it's important that we continue to do the research, and I think it's important that we continue to be aware of you know, all of the different components. But I also think it's important that we create a community of professionals to support people if they need that. And so that's what this bill does, and I just really wanted to say thank you for bringing it forward and to helping us move whole communities, whole families forward with high quality support for addiction. So thank you.
Representative Cagle, we're down to just a couple of minutes, so you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, one of the things that we've been working on through the OREC committee is the workforce development issues, and so that is something that we've been hearing directly from the community. And then also another thing that we've been seeing is that since the enactment of the prescription monitoring program, prescribing rates have gone down, but our overdose rates have not. And so we really need to get a handle on this and make sure that our medical professionals are trained and available in all parts of our state. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Members, I'm going to sign off with this. On Thursday, beside the bills, we're having the University of Minnesota back. They're going to explain their $97.5 million request addition. They have presented it to the Regent. Some of you already know what would happen if they don't get it according to the Regent presentation. But I would hope that all of you would be here and ask questions once they give us the final numbers. So with that, meeting is adjourned.